Let's start what we have come into the room to do. Right on. Here goes.
One, two, three.
Hello, Ann Arbor and the world. This is It's Hot in Here, and this is WCBN FM Ann Arbor. Here to my right is the fantastic Andrea Kraus.
Wishing you a very happy new year, Ann Arbor.
Yes, and the world.
And the world.
If we could wish you all a happy new year, we are. We're doing it right now. Hey, a little updates in our world. Paul Stromberg, our engineer, has transitioned on. He is now doing some excellent student teaching. And so he's no longer with us, but that means we have a new engineer. Yes, Gus Turner.
Hello, hello, hello.
Hello, Gus. Gus is majoring in English, which is a great language, and minoring in art history.
That is true.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Hey, Gus, what's your favorite thing about WCBN?
It's hot in here.
That's wonderful.
Oh, what a surprise.
Yeah, we did not rehearse that at all. We're also bringing back an old tradition and making it new again of having a word of the day a la Pee-wee's Playhouse. What's the word of the day today, Gus?
It is cold.
Ah. So cold in the D.
So when you hear cold, you also might be reminded how cold it is in the D. Well, we have a very special show today. We are taking a little trip to Warsaw, Poland, to talk about the most recent climate change negotiations. And with us in the studio are three students of School of Natural Resources and Environment at the University of Michigan, as well as some other affiliations that they have. But let's take a little musical break, and then we will come back and learn more about our fantastic guests. So this is Give It Up with J Live, etc.
South and west, it's obvious enough why the planet's so stressed now. Someone say to be here is to be blessed, but the world got issues that we must address. It's like whether you rest on the poor, worse the best. The devil got his hand all up the earth, dressed with the toxic elements we waste, use, and test. You need to reconsider where you choose to invest, cause hell have no wrath like a woman scorned. Do you really want beef with your mama nature? She wants clean air and water for her next born. And I don't know if I could diss her just to get the paper, cause all the money in the world couldn't buy you a place to stay unless you spend it on the planet, son. Now some of y'all might be shooting for the stars, but I ain't trying to live on Mars, so check it out and go. Give it up for the earth, ladies and gentlemen. She holding it down for now. Do your thing, man. You know we know products of the environment. You don't want to bust it in the early retirement. Give it up for the earth, ladies and gentlemen. She holding it down for now. Do your thing, girl. She on the dance floor. The sun is a disco ball. It's getting hot in here. Too hot for all y'all.
Hey, yo, I hope the game's tight. There's only 9 girls in the club, but the one that gets live. The mother shorties ain't giving you the time of day. She got the courage plus the move to blow your mind away. The type of girl that you would want to raise a family with. But just know she don't go for the bullshit. She can kill you with kindness of a cold shoulder. Lies about her age. Nowadays she looking older. Through a green dress showing up a full figure. Shorty's rich. Your man is the gold digger. He ain't treating her right. He don't respect her. She got his back and he don't even protect her. Pimping her. Running trains with his boys and filling the hemp with garbage, feeding the poison. You wanna step to what and handle your biz. Tell a man to step off and show up what time it is.
Give it up for the earth, ladies and gentlemen. She's holding it down for now. Do your thing, girl. She on the dance floor. The sun is the disco ball. It's getting hot in here. Too hot for all y'all. Give it up for the earth, ladies and gentlemen. She's holding it down for now. Do your thing, man. You know we all products of the environment. You don't want to force it in the early retirement. Now you can call me tree hugger for the time being. To the message in the bomb. A lot of scientists are warning about the global warming. I'm just wondering if you're seeing what I'm seeing. Cause big boy, you got you feeling like crack. Better yet, big medicine, they got you on the comeback. And if you wonder how they got it like that, big wig politicians getting real big kickbacks. Big tobacco letting little man choke on first hand. Not to mention
get more out of your tank with less emissions, but they're frontin' on the transition. Piss it away till we ain't got a pot to piss it. When nature calls to be the foolish ones that don't listen. All I know is we should take care of ours, cause I ain't tryna live on Mars. So check it out and go. Give it up for the earth, ladies and gentlemen. She's holding it down for now. Do your thing, girl. You know we all brought up to the environment. You don't wanna bust her in the early retirement.
So, welcoming our guests into the studio now, we have Jenny Cooper, Rachel Jacobson, and Chris Wolf, who are going to tell us a little bit about themselves before we get right into the climate negotiation talks. Jenny, could you tell our listeners who you are?
Yeah, for sure. First of all, thank you both for having us. This is a great opportunity to share our experiences and thoughts on the negotiations. I'm Jenny Cooper. I'm a second-year grad student pursuing a dual degree at the Erb Institute, which is a partnership between the Ross School of Business and the School of Natural Resources and Environment here at University of Michigan. Prior to coming to Ann Arbor, I spent 3 years working on international climate policy in Washington, D.C., and I was thrilled to get a chance to go back to the UN negotiations this year with my fellow students here.
Excellent.
Excellent. And Rachel Jacobson?
Yeah, thanks also for having me. And I'm Rachel. I'm a dual degree student with the School of Natural Resources and the Ford School of Public Policy in my second year, from the Metro Detroit area. And I also do work assessing resources available for local governments to do climate change adaptation, and I'm happy to be here.
Wonderful. And last but finally not least, Chris Wolf.
Thank you again, as everyone else has said, for having us today to share our experiences. Similar to Rachel, I am a dual degree master's student at SNRE, School of Natural Resources and Environment, as well as the Ford School of Public Policy. And you know, I went for similar reasons to my classmates. Simply put, I felt it offered an awesome personal learning opportunity, you know, sort of at the confluence of policy and environmental issues, and it certainly was an awesome experience.
That makes me very happy to hear. So all of you are at the School of Natural Resources, where many of us know quite a bit about some of these climate change negotiations. But for our listeners, could one of you maybe give a little bit of an intro? Where exactly did you go? What was it all about?
I was going to say, speak for yourself. I'm out of the loop now of climate change negotiations. So listeners, don't feel bad. That's all I'm saying.
That's true. I don't really know that much about it.
Humble she is. Yeah, so we're throwing around terms like COP19. What in the world is a COP? Why is it happening? Why have there been 19 of them?
Yeah, for sure. So there's a section of the United Nations called the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, or the UNFCCC. There's a lot of acronyms in UN negotiations, whether it's with regard to climate or human rights, anything, alphabet soup over there. So the UNFCCC has been around since the early 90s and came out of, you know, global concern about climate change and the need to have a global response to the challenges that climate change presents. So for a number of years, there's been annual negotiations in some ways, well, first of all, giving rise to the Kyoto Protocol, which was the world's first global climate treaty. And now there's additional negotiations going on, sort of what do we do to build on the Kyoto Protocol and or come up with a new global agreement to address greenhouse gas emissions as well as climate adaptation. So at the COP, or the Conference of the Parties, 194 countries come together every year to discuss a global response to climate change. So, you know, every country from, you know, Mali, Malawi, the U.S., France, Spain, Japan, China, you name it.
Was South Sudan there? Just out of curiosity.
I'm sure they had representatives there, but I'm not sure if they are a party in the formal sense of it to the UNFCCC.
Just curious.
I just wanted to jump in really quickly and say,
please,
on that note, I was wondering, you know, is a country like Syria going to be there? Mm-hmm. And I actually saw two Syrian delegates going into their mailbox Like, there's this one mail room where I guess you can exchange notes from country to country. I'm not exactly sure the system, but and I had this moment where I was like, you know, I had this instinct where this guy must be, is he this terrible guy? I mean, you know, considering everything that's going on there, it was just sort of like shocking to me, like, wow, this guy is from Syria. It was just very striking. So yeah, everyone, you name it, was certainly there. It was quite the experience.
What kinds of individuals are selected from the countries to go? That is to say, are they working for the government? Who did the United States send?
Yeah, so that's a great question. For the United States, the U.S. delegation is led by the State Department. It's mm-hmm. the Office of Global Change, and Todd Stern is the lead negotiator and sort of acts as you know, the equivalent of a minister of environment. So other countries, many of their negotiators come from their environment ministry with support from, you know, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So at State Department in the U.S., it's sort of a combination of those two entities that would be separate in other countries. And then in addition to negotiators from the State Department, there's also staff who come from the EPA or Department of Energy, the White House Council on Environmental Quality, mm-hmm. And other, you know, U.S. government representatives. And then for other countries, you know, you have like a Saudi Arabia, who I think their lead negotiators are from the, you know, Department of Oil and Extraction or Natural
that
Resources and Oil Extraction, something like that.
Yeah.
So you have, you know, folks from government from all over the world, from all different parts of government and different government systems. And it's fascinating to see how those various national systems, you know, sort of interact with one another.
And one thing we saw, too, and we'll get to equity later on in the discussion, but just the sizes of the different delegations was just striking. I mean, the U.S. is just, seems like everyone from the U.S. went over to participate, whereas some countries, you know, just hardly had anyone. They had to hire outside folks who weren't even nationals of a specific country. It was, yeah, very striking, like the differences and sort of the playing field, really.
Well, I look forward to getting into that. As we're getting ready to transition deep into Warsaw, what was it like to be there in mid-November?
So it was actually not as cold as I expected. It was probably in the high 30s, low 40s. But there was this sort of mist that covered the city the whole time we were there, and a little bit of rain. And I would say the most striking thing was the sun set at about 3:15 every day.
Wow. Must be very far north.
Far north. And it's also actually even more so. It's just that it's really far east in the time zone. So that's the other thing.
Yeah.
And so we probably arrived at the negotiations around, you know, 9, 10 a.m. But we were there until, you know, maybe 8 to like the wee hours of the morning. And so we never saw the sunset. We barely saw the sun. And it was kind of a mole-like experience in a lot of ways.
In your blog, you mentioned a lot of tunnels and in and out to get to the main areas.
Yeah, we were in the National Soccer Stadium of Warsaw, or of Poland. Mm-hmm. And so if you can imagine a soccer stadium essentially turned into a convention center. So there were a lot of escalators, but you sort of had no idea where they were going to lead. And then all of the hallways were in a circle around the field. And so if you wanted to go to a room on one side of the circle, but you took the wrong escalator, you would basically have to walk around the entire building to get where you wanted to go, which sometimes seemed like a really good metaphor for what actually went on substantively at the negotiations as well.
I really like that. Well, let's get us further in the mood. In honor of the multiple countries and cultures coming together at these meetings, we're going to listen to a tune from the Warsaw Afrobeat Orchestra. This one is called Let It Flow. Thank you. right. That was the Warsaw Afrobeat Orchestra. Afrobeat, a vibe that is infecting the whole world with happiness. We are here with Jenny Cooper, Rachel Jacobson, and Chris Wolf talking about the most recent climate change negotiations.
So going back to what you guys just briefly mentioned about who is actually at these negotiations, who was at COP19, I was reading on a blog post that listeners can check out on the SNRE website, and we will provide a link to that on the blog as well. Mm-hmm. The blog post was actually called Late Night Reflections on Equity, and there was a lot of really great stuff, really interesting stuff on there about the way participation at the climate negotiations mirrored a lot of what we actually see in the world in terms of international relations. And Chris, I read a story that you shared on the blog post, which I would love for you to share with our listeners now.
Yeah, so I came into contact with a young lady named Ida, and she told me she was one of the negotiators negotiating on an issue of loss and damage, which we'll get to a little bit later, what exactly that refers to. But one of the focuses of the negotiations, and she told me she was from the United States, currently living in Australia. And I was like, okay, so you negotiated, you're one of our negotiators, or are you one of Australia's negotiators? She's like, no, I'm actually negotiating on behalf of the Dominican Republic. And I was like, that seems strange. Yeah, so... She's never been there, but that is sort of...
She's never been there.
Never been there. And that sort of goes back to what I said earlier, that equity is something that we saw time and time again, just things were not always a level playing field. You know, the U.S. brings a team of negotiators. You know, we had, like, there was a U.S. Center where we put on events and sort of could spread a certain message. And here's the Dominican Republic having to... you know, they don't have enough people I'm not sure exactly if it's whether it's funding or what it ultimately comes down to, but
someone's paying her to go.
Yeah. Jenny may be able to speak to this, but I believe she was telling me that it was either a combination of UN funds and some funds from the Dominican Republic. But in any event, it just didn't seem entirely right that, you know, I had no doubt in speaking with her that she was trying her hardest to represent the Dominican and, you know, advocate for their views. But, you know, that's certainly at some fundamental level of a conflict of interest. So I thought that was rather, rather striking.
Wow. I'm stricken.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of examples along those same lines. If you just think about the issue of language. So all the big plenaries at the negotiations are simultaneously translated into seven different languages. That's the seven languages that you would probably think of: Spanish, French, Arabic, those kind of things. If one of those languages isn't your native language, then even in the plenary situation, you're already having to do that translation on your own. And then when you get down to the real meat and potatoes of sitting around a negotiating table, there's no translation. All of those negotiations are conducted in English.
Okay.
So, you know, we're talking amongst ourselves about how difficult it was just being in Warsaw and ordering something off a menu in a restaurant, let alone sitting around a negotiating table and trying to advocate for the needs of the people in your country in a language that isn't your own. So that was also really, really striking to us.
And I can say firsthand, like, I was in one of these negotiating rooms and I saw two non-native English speakers to the negotiators. They were both from South America, and one was clearly getting very frustrated by what he perceived to be the intended use of a word in the text. And his friend, and it was clear to me that he was misunderstanding he was misinterpreting what was meant by the word. And his friend had to keep telling him, "No, this is what it's meant. This is what is meant by it. You're not understanding it properly." And to at some basic level to have, you know, when you're trying to, you know, come up with a final text that's going to be ratified, I can only imagine how frustrating it must have been for him to realize that he, you know, wasn't even understanding the intended use of the word, let alone whether or not he ultimately would agree with it or not, to not understand it in the first place. That, I mean, it was
or a different understanding of it. I mean, part of the difficulty I feel like with these kinds of things is there's this sense that if we just get everybody at the table, whoever that is, if we have all the stakeholders, quote, you can't see scare quotes on the radio, but they're there, that everything will work themselves out and that it will create this kind of equal situation. But simple things like the language you're using to communicate and then sign potentially binding agreements becomes really, really tricky.
I think it becomes very tricky, and I think thinking about and having a clear understanding of the equity issues and the sort of disparity in negotiating capacity among and between countries is important. But I think it's also important to recognize that, you know, the United Nations for more than 50 years has been a way for countries around the world to come together and collectively address global challenges.
Sure.
And so despite the difficulties, you know, I think this forum for negotiation is incredibly important, and incredibly important to engage in a manner that, you know, where you have a clear understanding of what are, you know, when you're talking to someone from another country who maybe you're speaking in English, but it's their, you know, second, third or fourth language. How do you go about communicating? What are the words that you're using? And making sure that there is that common understanding. So I think it's difficult to bring so many people together, but it's also, you know, just drives home the point that process is important. You don't want to get bogged down in process, but you need to make sure that you have a process that's accessible by all of the key stakeholders.
Mm-hmm. So how much does economic influence really play a role here? Because I also was reading in the blog on the same issue, aside from the matter of language, which is going to be complicated no matter what, because there are so many languages to be represented, you guys also wrote a little bit about workspace and lodging. Could you speak a little bit to that?
So attending a UN climate negotiation for a country is relatively, you know, expensive. Perhaps not in comparison to other parts of the national budget, but nonetheless, is a considerable expense, especially if you're coming from far off lands. You know, you have to rent out office space in the conference venue, pay for all your, you know, staff to come and negotiate on your behalf. But the UN, I think, does offer, you know, grants for least developed countries or countries that have difficulty in terms of financial capacity. So there is a mechanism to encourage and enable all countries to participate. And, you know, even so, you'll have a country with, you know, one or two negotiators, while a country like the U.S. or Brazil or China may have, you know, 40, 50, 60, 100 negotiators. So it totally depends.
Are there simultaneous negotiations going on?
Yes.
So if you only have two delegates,
it's very hard to cover. So there's a lot of alliances and sort of negotiating blocks, they're called, mm-hmm. where countries will sort of band together with common interests. And there's tons of them, mm-hmm. right? So you have the Association of Small Island States, AOSIS. You have Small Island Developing States, SIDS. You have the Africa Group. You have the G77 in China. You know, there's tons of different groups. And then you have the European Union, which is 27 member states, and they sort of negotiate both as individual states, but also most strongly collectively. And mm-hmm. so they have, you know, coordinating meetings every day, sometimes multiple times a day. You have to get all 27 countries on board with your negotiating plan. So it gets
Were they
tenuous.
Just pumping coffee out into a fountain in the main
yes.
part of the stadium? Okay.
We actually, on the first day that we were there, we were communicating via email the whole time because not all of us had SIM cards in our phones. And someone sent out an email that said, okay, let's meet at the coffee break station on this floor. And we all ended up in different places because there were like five coffee break stations just on that floor.
Thank goodness for that, though.
Right.
I'm sorry you guys didn't meet up.
We found each other eventually.
Yes. Wow. Beautiful. Let us listen to a tune, and then we'll come back to talk more about diplomacy and negotiations here. This is Nina Simone with the tune Revolution.
We're in the middle of a revolution because I see the face of things to come. Oh, your constitution, where are my friends?
gonna have to bend. I'm here to tell you about the destruction of all the evil. It will have to end. Notion, I know. They'll say I'm preaching hate. If I have to swim the ocean, well, I will, just to communicate. It's not as simple as talk and jive, a daily struggle just to stay alive. Pollution. Well, you know, you've got to clean your brain. The only way that we can stand, in fact, is when you get your foot off my back.
Welcome back to It's Hot in Here. This is WCBN FM Ann Arbor. And if you'd like to listen to a version of this show in the future or our other shows, we encourage you to check out our blog at hotinhere.us. So we've been talking about these climate change negotiations, but then the question comes to me, what is at stake in all of this? Why is this such a huge issue? Like, what are the specific, not so much specifics, but like overarching kinds of motivations for these kinds of negotiations?
Yeah, for sure. So as I think we all know, climate change is an issue that will affect everyone on the planet in different ways, but nonetheless has a global impact. And if you think about, you know, all of our daily activities, all of our infrastructure is built based on a set of predictable natural patterns. And as the climate changes and those patterns change and their predictability changes, we have to think about how to sort of reorganize or redesign or design for difference.
So, for example, rain-fed agriculture, or even not rain-fed agriculture.
Yeah.
We rely on fairly consistent, predictable seasonal changes to produce things like food at a very basic level.
And even things like just your water infrastructure in a city Mm-hmm. And so it's not even things that we necessarily think of as being totally tied to the land, and not even water infrastructure, because you could think water is a natural thing, but even just your skyscraper in an urban setting.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's really important both on pretty much every scale of governance and decision making to figure out how to both reduce the potential impacts of climate change, and sort of reducing greenhouse gas emissions that are causing climate change. And then on another side, figuring out how to adapt to the changes that are already locked in.
Mm-hmm.
And so these UN climate negotiations represent the global effort to figure out how to address these issues. And I think it's important to recognize, one, is that we're not going to, quote unquote, solve climate change through the UN negotiating system.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to solve climate change through any one negotiating forum. And so the UN negotiations are a piece of the larger puzzle. And we're at a point, I think, in terms of the science, where it's all hands on deck at this point, from, you know, mayors of cities to, you know, governors, presidents, and then the international bodies. And so in Warsaw, the negotiations were a continuation of previous year negotiations and looking forward to an agreement in 2015 that the UN, UNFCCC countries have agreed to agree in 2015 to a new global, some people call it a treaty, some people call it a legal instrument, some people call it just an international agreement, mm-hmm. on how to move forward with addressing climate change. So the negotiations in Warsaw were about emissions reductions, adaptation, so how to adapt to the changing climate, climate finance, loss and damage, and also just the legal architecture of the next international agreement. So is it legally binding? Is it something that needs to be ratified by countries? Is it just sort of a tacit agreement? What sort of legal architecture will it have?
Mm-hmm.
And so you can get very far into the weeds in terms of the policy issues themselves. But I think the key thing to sort of remember is that we weren't expecting a world-saving treaty coming out of Warsaw. We uh-huh. were expecting, you know, some progress towards the 2015 agreement. So
was there a sense of satisfaction with the progress at the conclusion of the meetings?
I think it depends on who you ask.
Sure.
Having attended these types of negotiations four different times, if you read various press releases of what actually happened at the negotiations, you know, you could read, an environmental NGO press release, and then you could read the European Union and the U.S. and India and the UN Secretariat press release, and you might think, were we all really at the same meeting? So I think it depends on what your expectations were going in,
mm-hmm.
And what your strategy is to approach the 2015 negotiations.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of plays into what people think happened there, or how they perceive the success or failure or something in between.
So to tie back a little bit with our equity conversation from before, it seems that not everyone is equally responsible for what has caused climate change. And at the same time, not everyone is equally sort of susceptible to the kind of unfolding risks.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it generally plays out that the countries that are most susceptible are the countries that are generally considered to be the least responsible. And so
responsible for
historical emissions.
Yes.
But what complicates that is you have changing patterns of vulnerability, both within countries and sort of globally. And then you have countries like China, for example, that are catching up very rapidly. And so you sort of lock in these almost stereotypes about different countries that actually, you know, can change over the course of just a few short years. But a couple of the big issues around that are, how do we determine who's historically responsible for climate change? And how do we balance sort of a sense of gratitude around the technological advances that came as a direct result from those greenhouse gas emissions, and the benefit that they had for the whole rest of the world, with the damage that they've caused to the climate. And so that's a really big issue. And then, you know, once we have a sense of how we're going to sort that out, there's a question of how we determine what does equitable burden sharing for both reducing emissions for the future and helping countries adapt to a changing climate. What does that equitable burden sharing look like? And how does the measurement of greenhouse gas emissions sort of play into that? So looking at whether you should measure a country's greenhouse gas emissions by unit of GDP, whether you should do it per capita, whether measuring greenhouse gas emissions by country is even the most appropriate way to go about it. So there are just so many kind of technical and social issues that play into it. And it does become pretty messy. But I think the important thing is having this international forum to talk those issues out with, like you were saying earlier, all the stakeholders at the table.
Mm-hmm. So, just out of curiosity, did you guys find that there was more of an emphasis on, you know, accepting, yes, climate change is happening, what can we do to adapt to the, you know, the difficult to foresee weather patterns? Or was the emphasis still more on mitigation? Or is there more of a, how do these two things complement each other? And then also, Jenny, you said you went to some of the previous ones. Has that changed? I'm just curious.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's definitely a lot more discussion and presentations, and maybe media buzz and engagement on adaptation, in my view, than there has been in years past. But I don't think it's a, okay, we're going to focus on adaptation now where, you know, climate change is inevitable and there's nothing we can do about it. That's not the context in which adaptation is being discussed. I think it's much more of a, you know, climate change is happening. There's, you know, the science says there's, you know, certain things that are going to happen no matter how much we reduce emissions in the near term.
And have already.
And have already, yeah. Mm-hmm. And we need to sort of be agile enough in our decision making and in our long term planning to take those into account, while simultaneously trying to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, you know, as quickly and effectively as possible. And you know, there's some countries for whom adaptation is a much more pressing issue than greenhouse gas emissions reductions. For example, you have Tuvalu, mm-hmm. you know, with their, you know, almost at sea level in terms of elevation. Maybe I think the highest point is maybe a couple meters.
There's some great videos about relocations of entire groups yeah. of people.
And so there's questions of relocation. There's a question of, you know, is our country habitable? Does it exist if it's underwater? Do we, you know, go and take our flag away from the UN?
Wow.
So those issues, you know, or you have, you know, a country like Bangladesh where, you know, their capital city has huge floods every year, and that's projected to get worse as sea levels rise. And, you know, what do you do with those millions of people? How do they come together as a community? How does the international community support their efforts to adapt to climate change? So, you know, for some countries, it's a much more near-term issue or present issue. For other countries, it's an issue of long-term planning. But I think there needs to be a lot more work on where adaptation and mitigation intersect and how you can sort of do both at the same time or do them both in a manner that complements the other actions.
Right on. Let's listen to some traditional rural polka, if you don't mind, from the Warsaw Village Band. And we'll be back with more. awesome. Chris Wolf, you had an anecdote to share with us.
Yeah, I just wanted to give people a sense of what it was like to be in one of the negotiating rooms. And I'll preface it by saying this was the second to last day of the negotiations. I got there, I think it was maybe about 11 a.m. in the morning. I got in line to get into the negotiating room. I didn't have a particular badge that gives you unlimited access. So you have to wait in line, wait in line for 2.5 hours, got inside. Yes, 2.5 hours, got inside. They were negotiating. 15 minutes later, they call a break. And I'm like, oh, God, that's unfortunate. I just waited that much time. But, you know, this was what I came here to see. So I'm going to stick it out. And they said they'll be back in an hour and a half. And, yeah, that's not too long. 5 hours later, I was still in the room. And I was only allowed to leave once to use the restroom because, again, my badge did not give me access in and out, unlimited. So anyway, back at 7 p.m., the negotiations continued, you know, really quite a feverish pace, going, you know, word for word in this text, country, 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 we agree, we don't agree, back and forth. And it was really fascinating. I had my own copy of the text, and I was, you know, editing, crossing out, you know, making notes here and there. And yeah, it was really fascinating. One of one of my favorite comments was someone said that the text had suffered a baptism because it was so watered down. That was probably my favorite line. But that aside, you know, it was about 2 hours of pretty intense negotiating. And then they called for a break, and I was, you know, it was maybe 10 p.m. and I was thinking, you know, maybe I should go home. And next thing I see, though, across the room is there's this sort of this collection of people is huddled around. And I walk over there just to see what's going on. And David or Todd Stern, our chief negotiator, I think he was leaving the room and sort of got like cornered by Venezuela's chief negotiator. And so it was the U.S., Venezuela. I know the EU was in there, Australia, India, a host of others just sort of huddled around in a circle. The very center was India's delegate with the text and a pen in hand. They were just going through word by word by word by word, just sort of trying to figure things out. And what struck me as something that was so fascinating was that just minutes prior, in particular, the Venezuela negotiator had sort of lashed out at developed countries, you know, sort of, you know, and accusations of blame and, you know, things aren't going anywhere. Sort of in agreement of the baptism remark that, you know, things are getting watered down. It's just not a very good text. But then just moments later, it was clear that, you know, for whatever reason, maybe she said that, you know, because you have to sort of toe the line in front of the press or, you know, sort of publicly, like, I held this position. But, you know, privately, it wasn't behind closed doors, but in effect, it was away from the table. It wasn't necessarily official. She was working just as hard as anyone else was to really, like, come together and, you know, come to an agreement. So ultimately, the text that was agreed upon the following day, some of the things that I saw up close were included, and some were not, but just in general, it was very, I guess, heartening to see everyone sort of take a step back from, you know, I'm supposed to, you know, put off this sort of front and I need to, you know, act a certain way. And really everyone is sort of in it together to try to figure out something that everyone could agree upon. And it was really, really good to see. It made me, you know, want to go back again and Peru 2014, Paris 2015, and maybe see if they can get something, you know, get something accomplished.
That's not a terrible travel schedule into the future.
I can live with it.
And everyone can use some more frequent flyer miles.
Exactly.
I'd say. It's been really, really cold lately, hasn't it? Yeah. Yeah. There was this talk, I mean, of climate sort of research vessels going up to the Arctic and then getting stranded in ice. A lot of conversation. It's just these like supreme ironies recently with regards to climate, and certainly some extreme weather events is what climate change is all about. Yes, I'm going to think more about what you just said, Chris, because that's actually really interesting to see these adversarial relationships, perhaps publicly, but hard work and collaboration that goes on less publicly in these things. I dig it.
It seems a little messy and a little inefficient, but it seems like the will is there, right, from everybody involved, and that's good to hear.
Mm-hmm. And I think one thing to highlight about Chris's story and what made it, what made the experience so fascinating is that this late night huddle, first of all, was happening like, you know, between the hours of midnight and 3 a.m.
And folks secondly, had already been up for hours and hours. Last, forget about jet lag.
Yeah, the last few days of a climate negotiations, negotiators are sleeping almost none. I mean, they're negotiating till 3, 4, 5 in the morning and then having coordinating meetings and then getting going again at 9 or 10 the next morning. So there's not a lot of sleep. Sometimes they just go straight through the night negotiating. But another thing to note is just that this huddle was made up of environment ministers from around the world. And these are super high-level people. And, you know, I think we're used to seeing them in a very formal context. And it was fascinating to me to see how you have a formal structure for the negotiations. You know, you have the chairperson and people are, countries are raising their, they're called flags, but nameplates to indicate that they have something to say or contribute. But then periodically, you know, a country will say, or the chair will say, I think we need to take 15 minutes, just break. You can, you know, call back to your country, see if what we're negotiating is okay, or talk amongst yourselves. And that's sort of how these huddles would start. And then all of a sudden you would see, you know, 100 environment ministers just going at it back and forth, and just seeing that sort of policy creation process and people at very high levels hashing things out in a similar manner to, you know, how you or I would do it. Mm-hmm. In terms of just the sort of,
I don't have a country to call, but
right.
Yeah.
But I mean, in terms of the sort of, it is just human communication. These, you know, folks aren't larger than life.
Mm-hmm.
It was a sort of, you know, sure it was inefficient, but it was also sort of a very human moment.
I mean, and would there be a more efficient way to even do that kind of thing? I mean, is efficiency?
If we can get robots to do it all for us, maybe.
Program
the climate change negotiations.
Then there will be accusations of robot tampering.
Yeah. And Google, are you out there?
Road priorities. Let's check another tune in honor of the coldness that has been going on. So cold.
So cold in the deep.
Just wanted to get a chance to play that several times. This tune is called Freezing by Mozella.
Like an old overcoat, the seasons may change.
feel so cold.
Well, Chris Wolf, who just shared his experiences at the negotiating rooms and also waiting in line for them, has left the building. He must go to class now, like many of us do.
That's right. Thank you, Chris. And to close, Rachel and Jenny, who are still here, what did this mean for you guys personally? You were there. You saw all the international people there as well. But what was it like for you, and what did you get out of it?
So I think there were sort of two main categories of things. One is just sort of, you know, I've been in international settings before, but never professional settings and never a situation like this at the negotiations. And, you know, there's always this feeling of like, I'm a little bit out of my element. Like, there's a language barrier. There's this. I don't feel totally comfortable. For me, there was a sense at the negotiations that wasn't really present, that everyone really was kind of there with a shared goal. And it created this shared experience where that sort of cultural barrier, even though there was every cultural barrier you could possibly imagine, kind of disappeared in a lot of ways. And that was a really cool thing for me to sort of see, just how everyone came together around a common goal. And similarly, you know, I sort of thought that I would be exposed to a lot of new ideas, and I was exposed to some new ideas, but my main takeaway was actually how similar all of the challenges are, regardless of if you're in a developing country or a developed country, if you're in an arid region, if you're in, you know, a tropical region. Like, you know, obviously there are differences, but the similarities were actually what was most striking to me. Yeah, and then beyond that, just sort of like the personal professional development that being at the conference offered. I had lunch one day, just sort of randomly sat down at a table because there were no other seats with, you know, someone who worked in the royal government of Thailand, and he was like this really high up guy. We were just chatting about climate technology, and like that was it, you know, and it was sort of totally normal for us to be sitting there.
That's wonderful. And you guys saw some people from Michigan there too, right?
We did. So a highlight for me was actually going to a high-level discussion on urban climate planning and the role of cities in addressing climate change. And one of the speakers was Mayor George Hartwell from Grand Rapids, Michigan. And I was sort of, oh, you know, Grand Rapids is here represented in the UN climate negotiations. What's going on? This is wonderful. And Mayor Hartwell spoke so eloquently and so diplomatically, you know, sitting on a panel with environment ministers from other countries, from in addition to Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General of the United Nations, Cristiana Figueres, the Executive Secretary of the UNFCCC. So this was a very high level discussion. And, you know, Grand Rapids just rocked it. It was great. And I think, you know, that's one of the things I think is really important about the UN climate negotiations and figuring out sort of a global means of addressing climate change is that we can't just have, you know, a UN negotiating session on climate change and then national policy and local policy, but we really need to figure out how to weave those different levels of policymaking and decision making together and make sure that they're supporting each other. And working sort of in concert so that we have, you know, an international agreement on climate that supports national legislation and national legislation that supports state and city regulation and action, and sort of ensuring that all of that is woven together in a manner that enables us to effectively address the challenges that we face. The other thing that I really enjoyed about the climate negotiations and why I decided to go back for the fourth time is just, you know, you have NGOs there, you have folks in the private sector, you have government, and you have all these people trying to work together. And it's a really great setting for students, for professionals, and especially for University of Michigan in terms of getting the name recognition internationally, both for Michigan and SNRE and Ross School of Business and Ford and ERB. So it's a great, great opportunity overall.
Well, fantastic. Well, I am proud to say that you represented our good name here at the University of Michigan, all the way in Warsaw at COP19.
Yeah, thank you to you guys.
Thanks for having us.
Yes. So once again, thank you to Jenny Cooper, Rachel Jacobson, and Chris for joining us on It's Hot in Here. You can check out our blog at hotinhere.us.
And thank you to Gus Turner for making sound appear on the radio for us.
Happy to be here.
I love the idea of sound appearing on the radio. So it's winter, which means it's pretty cold.
So cold in the
deep. Yeah. What a great tune. So let's go out on a song, Winter Weather. This is by the Squirrel Nut Zippers. Have a great weekend, everyone. And we will see you, hear you. Let's hear us each other back next week when our special guest will be Sarah Besky, who has recently published a fantastic book about Darjeeling tea called The Darjeeling Distinction. So there'll be lots of fun things to get into there. Thank you much, and more soon.